We're doing Netivot Shalom on Parshat Korach, and the topic is Chomer HaChet Shel Korach, the severity of Korach's transgression. Vayomer Moshe said to them, "Bezot tedun ki Hashem shlachani lasot et kol ha'masim ha'ile." With this, you will know that Hashem sent me to do all these things. Kilo milibi, I didn't do it of my own volition. In kimot kol adam yimutun eile, if these people die a natural death, ufkudat kol adam yipaked alehem, and what happens to them is what happens to ordinary people. Lo Hashem shlachani, then Hashem has not sent me. Vim b'riya yivra Hashem, but if Hashem creates a new creation, ufatzeta adama et piha, uvala otam et kol asher lehem, and the ground opens its mouth and swallows them and everything they own, v'yaredu chayim sheola, and they go down alive into the grave, v'idatem ki niyatzu anashim eret Hashem. Then you will know that these people blasphemed against Hashem in their argumentativeness against me. Tzarich be'ur ma'u godel chomer ha'chet shel Korach, ad shelo hayadai b'chol anashim sheyesh b'torah. We have to understand, why was Korach's action so severe that no punishment that's written in the Torah is enough? There had to be a new creation created in order to punish them. As the verse says, if Hashem creates a new creation, even with the most weighty sins, it doesn't say such a punishment that a person goes down alive and is swallowed alive into the ground. We don't have such a punishment in Torah. We find further in this parasha that the Torah goes great extents to tell us the severity of Moshe's of Korach's actions. Shneimal, the verse says, "Suhunam ala ole anashim arshim ha'il v'altigu b'chol shalahem petisafu b'chol chatotam." Moshe tells the Jewish people, "Stay away from Korach's tent. You don't want to be taken down with all of their transgressions." Shlomatzim kazotot b'shum makom b'Torah. You don't find this anywhere else in Torah. Ad kidei kach shasu afilu b'magav v'kirva, that the Torah says, "Don't touch this person. Don't come close to this person." Further, we have to understand the mashma'ut b'madichtivi badelu mitoch haidan ra'azot v'achale otam kiraga. Hashem tells Moshe and Aaron, get away from all these people. I'll wipe them out all at once. In a split second, Hashem tells Moshe, I'll wipe everyone out. And then afterwards, when the nation complains a second time, after Korach dies and the 250 people die, the next morning people come and say, it's all your fault, Moshe and Aaron. What does Hashem say to Moshe and Aaron? Heiromu mitoch haidan ra'azot v'achale otam kiraga. Again, the same word in an instant. Hashem says, get away from them, he says to Moshe and Aaron, and I'll kill them all in an instant. But Torah, we don't find this anywhere else in the Torah that Hashem says, in an instant, everyone will drop dead. Why is it that over here with Korach, Hashem says, in an instant, right now, I'm going to punish them? Why is it that Hashem says, we can't delay? There has to be a reaction right away. We have to understand further. The pasuk says that Korach and Datan Aviram and their wives and children and little children were all swallowed up. Rashi brings a medrash. Look at how difficult, how terrible it is when people are argumentative. The courts down below don't punish a person before they're mature adult. You have to be 13. You have to bring two hairs of adulthood. And the courts up above don't punish until a person's 20 years old. And over here, even the babies died. So that's what's going on here. What's so weighty? And finally, the Netivot Shalom has two more questions. He says, and furthermore, we have to understand that what did the children do wrong? And even if you tell me that a machloket is so severe, but what are you punishing babies? They're not worthy of punishment. The Medrash says everything went down. It says that anything Korach owned would come rolling, tumbling down to go down with him. Nothing could be left from Korach. It's almost like Amalek, right? By Amalek, it says erase their memory even from upon the stones. Why? Why over here is it so... Shalom, shalom. Why over here is it so severe? Okay, so the Netivot Shalom illustrated from many different angles that what happened with Korach is very severe. Number one, we don't find the person goes down alive. No such punishment in Torah. Number two,
We don't find that the Torah has to invent a new punishment to her, to punish someone. Here by Korach, we see something unusual. Furthermore, we see Hashem tells Moshe and Aaron, stay away from them. I'm going to wipe them out in a split second. What's the issue here that it has to happen so immediate? We find the Medrash says, even the children were punished. Why? And finally, why were children punished, Be'emet? Why? What did they do? So the Netivot Shalom has a long piece on this. I don't think we're going to finish the whole piece tonight. It's a piece with many sections. It's the longest piece on the parsha, I think. So we'll cover what we can. Yeah.
Two quick things. One, isn't in Perkei Avot where we read that like at twilight of the first Shabbos that the mouth would be
right?
So how can this be a new punishment that was created when it was already there?
That's a good question for Thursday night. Remind me after, later on tonight, we'll get back to it, okay?
And secondly, in almost every instance with like conflict with the Jewish people, children were involved, right? With the Canaanites and Amalek and now Korach. So is it really so like different than, I don't know, he's pointing it out as something that's like unusual.
I agree. I think your question is very good. Yeah. Yeah, you could argue Irani Dachat. We have other examples in Torah where children are involved, right? I agree. Okay, he says, sometimes we find things in Torah that the Torah doesn't overtly state how severe they are. And what they cause, the blemish that they cause, can be more severe than the most severe transgressions that are in Torah. This is an idea that he mentions a few times. He says one of the examples is the story of Korach. And the Torah considers what Korach did to be something that was so extraordinarily bad, worse than anything that preceded it. You never had something this with such a gravity as what happened with Korach. Our sages say that whoever argues with his Rebbe, whoever says, I'm going out against my Rebbe, so then says, though he's going out against Hashem. And when a person starts yelling and being upset at his Rebbe, it's like he's going out against Hashem. And when a person starts thinking maybe he doesn't know what he's talking about and maybe he's not worth anything, he's thinking that about Hashem. So the question here is, why? Why did our sages equate a person's Rebbe with Hashem? And whenever we hear such a term, our sages say about Rabbo, it sounds like any Rebbe who's teaching him Torah. Why? But maybe he's not so great. Why does he deserve such an honor? And how come our sages would equate that with the Shechina? It seems very, very severe. So he says, our sages tell us in the Midrash Tanchuma, it says in the Pasuk, Uvoti Dvak, connect to Hashem. But you can't. Hashem's like a burning fire. How could you connect to Hashem? So our sages say it means connect to those who teach Torah. When you connect to them, it's as though you're connecting to the Shechina. So now he's bringing a Hasidic thought, which is not only a Hasidic thought. There are other sources for it as well. But the Hasidim put a big stress on this, that the connection to a tzaddik is the essence of the Torah and the mitzvos. And through Torah and mitzvos, you connect to Hashem. This is all one idea. Now, you understand how dangerous this idea is, right? I always stress here at Machon Meir, you're connecting to the Ribbono Shel Olam. And even if your rabbi will unfortunately disappoint you one day, that's difficult, and it's a very hard thing that happens, but you're still connected to the Ribbono Shel Olam. You have to be connected to Hashem. And even if you suddenly discover that this person who you thought represented holiness and purity and righteousness and piety, he's a fake. We hope that never happens, right? But it could happen. And sometimes it's a misunderstanding, and sometimes it's not. Sometimes you suddenly realize this person is not what I thought this person was. But as hard as that is, your connection has to be with Hashem. And even though you connect with the Rebbe, and you try to connect as much as possible, and hopefully you grow from that connection, but your connection ultimately is with Hashem. So I always stress that. That's the misnaget in me. But the Hasidim always stress the other side. And I'm not saying that the other side isn't important. I can tell you that when I was learning by Rav Pesin Zatzal, I would come and shovel his walk.
I would come in and cut down the branches which were blocking the, when they'd grow into the path into his house, I'd cut them down. When I was in Rabbi Feinstein's yeshiva, I bought a car in order to be able to give him a ride whenever I could. Because I knew that I would learn at least as much from servicing the teacher. And anyways, if I'm getting so much, I'm happy to give something back. I'm telling you, I bought a car. I brought it to the Lower East Side with that purpose alone. It stood there parked all week. I didn't use it. You know, parking's horrendous in Manhattan. Where was I going? From the dorm to yeshiva to the dorm to yeshiva. I wasn't going anywhere. The whole reason I held on to that car, and I worked to fund that car, was for that. And I learned a lot from it. So I'm not contesting this idea. I'm just saying it's a dangerous idea. It's an important idea. You have to know how to balance it out.
V'yesh inyanim miyuchadim shekocham gadol biyoter l'avi yodi l'tachlit liyot avuk b'Hashem.
And there are things that bring a person really close to connecting to Hashem, and that's why they're so important. On the other hand, there are things that will make a person very distant from Hashem, and they cause them to be severed from connecting to Hashem, and that's why they're so severe. And our sages said that if you want to know what's the path, how you connect to Hashem, connect to Chachamim. If you connect to Chachamim, that's going to help you connect to Hashem. The truth is, it's very hard to connect to Hashem. It's beyond us. But when a person connects to his Rebbe and he says, okay, I respect what he says, and even though I don't always understand it, I'm going to respect it, so then he can connect to Hashem. It's interesting. I had the good fortune of learning by quite a few rabbis, and when I learned, let's say, by Rabbi Feinstein's, I felt he was so much bigger than me that if he said something, even if I didn't really understand it, I was willing to go with it because I had that much respect for him. I learned by Rabbi Pesson Zatzal, same thing. I learned by Rabbi Halberstam Zatzal, also same thing. When he said something, I had so much respect for it. Sometimes I didn't agree with him. Sometimes I didn't understand it, but I respected that. I respected what he said, even when I didn't understand it. And then there was a rabbi who I learned by, who I respected very much. But I didn't feel like if I didn't understand what he said, I was going to go by what he said. I felt like I respect him, but there are things that he's going to say that are not in line with my tradition. And I know, for example, Rabbi Feinstein said differently. It's a different tradition than my tradition. And I kept asking myself, should I continue learning by him? Because he's a big Talmid Chacham. But his tradition is different than mine. And I was at odds with myself. And in the end, I said, no, it's not right to take his time, and it won't bring me forward. It becomes encyclopedic. It becomes that I'm learning in order to have notes to know what he holds, but it's not what I hold. I have a different tradition. My tradition, you know, went a certain way. And at this point, to learn someone else's tradition, and suddenly you see it's different. And it's different on points where it makes a difference. So the second I came to realization, I'm not going to do this. He's going to say things and I'm going to say, but my tradition is different and I'm not going to end up going with him. So then to go and learn by a rabbi when it's encyclopedic. So I have notebooks from the time I spent learning by him where I know what he holds. I know what he holds. I'm telling you, I have full notebooks of questions that I ran by him. But then I said to myself, this isn't how you learn by a rabbi. If you're not going to accept what he says at the end, So then Torah is not supposed to be encyclopedic. It's not just, hey, he says this and he says that and he says that. Now, learning by a Rebbe means I have a Rebbe. And if he says it, I'm going to go by it. You know, people sometimes ask me questions about Shabbos clocks. And I say, don't ask me. My tradition, I learned by Rabbi Feinstein's yeshiva. Rabbi Feinstein was very stringent about Shabbos clocks. I think most people don't go that way. Most people are lenient. They ask someone else. People ask me, can I open a bag of milk on Shabbos? And I say, don't ask me. My tradition is with Rabbi Feinstein. Rabbi Feinstein held you're not allowed to, but everyone in Israel does. Other rabbis hold it's permissible. There's no reason you should be bound by Rabbi Feinstein. If I'm your local Orthodox rabbi, okay, just like I'm stuck with my tradition, you're stuck with my tradition. Stuck, I say, you know, with figuratively. But if it's just you asked me because I'm local, so ask someone else who's local. They'll be far more lenient for you. And there are other things that way. But that's my tradition. So if that's my tradition, that's the way I go. For good, when it's more comfortable or when it's less comfortable. It doesn't obligate other people. but it's a direction, it's a path, it's a tradition. And even if I wouldn't necessarily have thought that way, and I personally argued with Rabbi Feinstein more than once that maybe we should be more lenient about opening bottles, about opening bags, and he didn't agree. He didn't agree. Didn't help me. And I could give you other examples of things I argued with. At the end of the day, he didn't agree with me. Fine. He's smarter than me. It's why I have a Rebbe Gemano. I respect it. I go with it. So he says, but connection to a Rebbe that's going to bring you close to Hashem has to be a Rebbe that you respect and you say, I'm going to go with it all the way, even if I don't necessarily agree. Yeah?
We're not talking about Hashkafa. We're not talking sort of outlook. We're talking, Rabbi Feinstein says, if you open a bag or a bottle, you're being a Chalal Shabbat.
He doesn't say it's the right in every instance, okay, but let's say, yeah.
That seems to be an intimation here that he holds that in this issue, you are not permitted to do it because he holds that if you do do it, you're making a Shabbat. So how can we get to the point where it's not, like you said, it really makes a difference? For one rabbi, it's not a kula, it's not within the framework of it's halakhically permissible. This is a case where he's holding it's not permissible, and this rabbi saying it is permissible. So it's not a question of degree. It's a black and white issue. You either are or not keep your
Shabbat. I'm not sure things are so black and white. I'm saying there's there are points where Rabbi Feinstein also, I think, would agree it's not biblical, for example. You open a bag of milk, you're going to throw out that bag of milk, you're not going to reuse it. But Rabbi Feinstein still holds you're not allowed to open a bag of milk on Shabbat. You open a bottle, most people don't reuse the bottle. They're going to throw it out. But you see, there within halacha, we have room for two opinions. It's not.
He's not saying that by doing so, he's not putting a fence around something. He's saying this is the rule, this is the border you're crossing.
Right, but we have such machlokot in halacha. Bet Shammai and Bet Hillel held different views about who you're allowed to marry. And certain children, they held by one another, were mamzerim. They held you're not allowed to marry that relative. There's no mitzvah of yibum in such an instance. And then there would be a biblical prohibition to marry that person. Yareg val yavor, the child is a mamzer, it's karet. And yet, the Mishnah says, Bet Shammai and Bet Hillel respected one another's opinions. They would marry one another, only they'd always keep one another informed. According to your opinion, this is not kosher, so don't marry these girls of ours. So they kept one another informed. I'm saying in halacha, we have that amount of liberalism, where so long as it's within the system, you're working within the system, you're entitled to come to another conclusion. You know, Shlomo Zalman Orbach wrote a whole response to arguing on Rabbi Feinstein. And in the beginning of the responsa, he writes a footnote. He says, I sent this responsa to Rabbi Feinstein, and I asked him if I'm allowed to publish it, because he held Rabbi Feinstein knew how to learn better than him, yet he didn't agree with him. So he asked Rabbi Feinstein, am I legitimate in writing this? They once came to Rav Pesen Zatzal, and they said the yeshiva's putting out a yeshiva pamphlet with halachot, with the responsa. Could you submit something to the responsa? So someone had asked him, they found in Auschwitz, they found a burnt piece of a Torah scroll. And they wanted to put it on display in a shul. Is it permissible or prohibited? They didn't tell Rav Pesen that they asked Rabbi Feinstein the same question. And Rabbi Feinstein wrote a whole response of writing it's prohibited. And Rav Pesen wrote it's permissible, but it could be I got it backwards. Each one wrote a whole responsa explaining why he held that way. But no one told Rav Pesen that the question was forwarded then to Rabbi Feinstein and that he wrote a responsa. Comes time to publish the pamphlet. It's publishing time. Rav Pesen submits his responsa. They're about to publish it, and they see it, and they say, hey, he was in the yeshiva at the time. He was learning under Rabbi Feinstein. They come back, and they tell Rav Pesen, you know, your responsa is against the Rosh Yeshiva. He wrote a response of the exact opposite. So he said, what do you want me? You asked me, this is what I thought. So they said, we're pulling it out. We're not publishing you. So he said, fine. If that's what the Rosh Yeshiva says, fine. They said, we didn't ask him. So why don't you ask him? So they brought Rabbi Feinstein what Rav Pesen wrote. And Rabbi Feinstein went over it, and he said, he's entitled. He said, I have my opinion. But what he wrote is also a legitimate opinion in halacha. Publish what he said too. And they published it. Published in the Yeshiva Journal. Rabbi Pesin's response, which is the exact opposite conclusion than Rabbi Feinstein. Rabbi Feinstein told them, this is a legitimate opinion in halacha, even though I don't agree with it. And I wrote a whole response the other way. Publish it. It's worth publishing.
So are you saying that in this realm, one person is right and one person is wrong, but in a higher realm, they're both correct?
No, I'm saying that in our world, the Torah was given to us with laws of derivation and laws of inference. After a person has purified themselves and their view of Torah is an objective, honest, distilled view, it's not partial. It's not because I want the response to be this way. It's not because I'd like Chazal to have said that way. It's because I'm looking at the text, I'm working very hard to figure out what our sages taught, and then I'm going to work with the laws and the system we have on tradition. So then there's room to reach opposite conclusions. And our tradition is that God said that to Moshe at Sinai. Our tradition is that at Sinai, Hashem told Moshe Rabbeinu, you have laws of derivation, you have laws of inference. Learn them, distill them, perfect them, understand them to a perfect degree, and then apply them. And then you will have different opinions in Am Yisrael. So long as you have a high court, you'll reach one conclusion. Because you'll come to accounting, and the human component within us makes it that what seems more logical to you might not seem as logical to me. And we'll argue it out, and at the end of the day, either we'll convince one another, or we won't. If we haven't convinced one another, then we have machloket. So long as we have a high court, we'll reach a bottom line. If we reach a bottom line, well, that's the halacha. The majority wins. You don't have a high court, both opinions are legitimate. And so, in the time of the destruction of the Second Temple, you had Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus, who was of the opinion that you're allowed to desecrate Shabbat for all preparations of a circumcision. And it says that when they would have a circumcision on Shabbos, they would cut down trees, they would put on a fire, they would make special knives for the circumcision in Rabbi Eliezer's town, because he was the chief rabbi, and he was a very legitimate opinion in halacha, and he ruled that you're allowed to do that. So because they loved the mitzvah so much, they wouldn't prepare a knife from yesterday. They would do it all on Shabbat. And it says that when the Romans made a decree that no one's allowed to circumcise, they put a special clause, that town is allowed to circumcise. And our sages saw in that, so to speak, an omen, that because that town was so dedicated to the mitzvah, they went with their Rebbe, and they did it on Shabbos, even with all the other desecrations of Shabbos, that's why they were free of the decree, they were allowed to circumcise. Rabbi Yossi HaGalili in the Galilee permitted people to eat chicken with milk. He disagreed with the rabbis. The rabbi said it's forbidden rabbinically, and he said, no, it's not. And in his town, they ate chicken with milk. So once you don't have a high court, then when you're working within the system and you're on the level that you're permitted to have an opinion, so then you can rule, and you don't have to go with the other opinion. And then, but you have to know the system. That takes many, many years, and it takes a pure heart. You know, it really takes being honest, and a lot of humility. A lot of humility. It, you know, the more humble a person is, the more they'll get to the truth. That's why Moshe Rabbeinu was the greatest rabbi, because he was the most humble. Yes.
Why it was a ruling that it was correct to break the Shabbos for the preparation for the with all the things that they make, the knives, whatnot, chopping. Like, what was the rationale behind that?
It's not so much a question of rationale. When you learn the Talmud in Shabbos that discusses that, you see it's about laws of derivation, laws of inference.
Okay.
It's how we understand the verses. But again, understanding the verses, you have to be so honest. You have to be so impartial, and you have to have such a grasp of the laws of derivation. It's not just this is what I think the verse is saying. It's you know, there are laws of inference, there are laws of logic. You have to really master them. And then you're entitled to an opinion, like Rav Lez Ben Hyrcanus was entitled. Back to the Netivot Shalom. So we were talking about the idea that the mitzvah of connecting to Hashem can be accomplished. Firstly, he said that mitzvah is a central theme of the Torah, to the point where the Kabbalists will say that that's the essence of Torah, to connect to Hashem. And our sages say that one of the vehicles to doing that is connecting to one's teacher. When a person really connects to a teacher and he feels an extension of that, so then he also connects to Hashem. Valken. And that's why when a person argues on his Rebbe, when he comes out and says, what does he know? So then what he's really doing is arguing on that which he's supposed to be connecting through his Rebbe. When a person starts yelling at his Rebbe, when a person starts thinking maybe he doesn't know what he's talking about, so then he's really thinking maybe the Shechina that he represents doesn't know. And that's what our sages say, that Datan v'Aviram, when they came out blaspheming, what they really said was, we don't care if God says that Aaron should be the high priest. We don't agree. We see how it actually came to fruition, that when the Rebbe was legitimate, it's Moshe Rabbeinu, so then when people come out against him, so then they're not really coming out against him. They're coming out against who he represents. And if the Rebbe is a vehicle to connecting to Hashem, when a person runs away from his Rebbe, part of what he's running away from, he's really running away from connecting to Hashem. And that's the gravity of the transgression of Korach. Korach comes in and says, everyone's holy. God's in the midst of all of us. Why are you guys being so arrogant? He says to Moshe and Aaron. But his argument really had no validity. The Torah attests that Moshe was the most humble of men. Notice, it was the end of last week's parasha. Just before Korach, the Torah came and told us who Moshe is and what Moshe is all about. But the essence of what Korach did wrong was that Korach came and said, you can't believe the rabbis. You can't believe the tradition. If he's coming against Moshe, what he's really saying is, you can't believe the oral tradition. And when you come like that, then you're really saying, there's no real connection to Hashem. Because you're arguing on the core of Torah. So then really it is more weighty than anything else. If a person transgresses, he eats pork. A person goes and he bows down to a Buddha. A person commits adultery. But deep down inside, he knows there's a Ribbono Shel Olam. So then he can connect again. But when a person comes and says, you guys are just being arrogant, what he's saying is, you can't trust any rabbi. You can't trust Moshe. You can't trust anyone. And then he's saying, there's no real way to connect to Hashem. And when a person is willing to sever that connection with Hashem, he's not just severing the connection with Moshe. He's saying there's no real way to connect to Hashem. There's no real representation down below. So then he's really arguing on a core concept of Judaism, which is the capacity to connect to the Ribbono Shel Olam. Moshe comes back and says, Hashem will create something. He says, there's nothing in the world that's fitting what you just did. What you're trying to do is sever the root, the tie of Am Yisrael with Hashem. There's no punishment that's enough for you. But Hashem can create something new. And then Hashem can show you. And with this we can understand why this specifically, with regards to this, Hashem says, don't touch anything they own, because you might end up being dragged down with them. And why is it that children went down? It says, even if Korach had lent a needle to a neighbor, that needle would come rolling down to be swallowed with Korach. That's what the Midrash says. Why? Hashem does everything exactly. Hashem says, I love justice. So then why did children have to go down? What does it mean even a needle of Korach had to go down? So the Tivot Shalom says as follows. I'm warning you in advance, you might not like his answer. He took on a big question. The Torah teaches in this parasha that when a person argues on his Rebbe and comes out and says, forget him, so then it's like a disease. And a disease, that one of the things about a disease is that it's contagious. And when Hashem comes and says, stay away from their tent, stay away from these wicked people, from everything they own, because you might be drawn down with them, that's because this disease is so contagious. To the point where even if you come close to it, even if you just touch something that he owns, then you can be affected. And Hashem says this has to be eradicated to the point that there's no remembrance, there's nothing left. And so everything Korach owned, everything that was connected to Korach had to be eradicated. And that's part of why Hashem says, I will eradicate them in an instance. Why? Because they can take down so many more people with them. You can't leave such a thing around. If people only come close, there are diseases which are so contagious that anyone who comes in contact is in danger. By the way, we have to think about what he just said. What he's saying is that there's every one of us can catch what Korach had. What he's saying is that any person is susceptible. No one's immune system is so strong that he can say, I won't come a day and say they're all liars. It's all a fake. That's a very scary thought, but that's what our sages said. You had a high priest after 80 years, he's so pious, and he comes out and says the rabbis are all a fake. Forget them. It tells us something about our situation, how susceptible every one of us is. What would happen if the person had a needle from Korach? What would happen is the person would say, you see, something stayed from Korach. You know, there's a very, very funny Gemara at first glance. The Talmud says when Moshe came to the Egyptians and said, tomorrow at midnight, God's going to kill all the firstborn. So it says, Moshe said at approximately midnight. So the Gemara says, why did he say approximately? He wasn't sure God would get it right. Of course he knew God would get it right. So the Gemara says, yeah, he knew God would get it right, but maybe the Egyptian clocks would be off. And then the Egyptians would say, you see, Moshe's a fake. Give me a break. If their clock is off by 2 minutes, what would they say? Moshe's a fake? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. You see that? It says that if the woman who was a sota drank the waters and you didn't see right away that she would explode, people would say, even though she exploded. But what would people say? No. Maybe it's something else. What do you mean it's something else? She drank the waters. It took her 3 minutes. The Talmud says no. Right away her eyes would start bulging and they'd have to rush her out so she wouldn't defile the whole temple. It says hey, right away the explosion would begin, like the deterioration of the body till it exploded. Because otherwise people would say it must be something else. That shows us something phenomenal about ourselves. How much we're willing to look at something and say, maybe there's a different reason. We're so into challenging. So Korach was very dangerous. And to my mind, we have remnants of Korach. People like to say that Amalek is around in every generation. And I think it's far more important to recognize that Korach is around in every generation. I think that's a far more important message than Amalek. I think the dangers of Korach, the dangers of being argumentative, unnecessarily argumentative, the dangers of being jealous, the dangers of trying to sever that tie, I think they're far more relevant to every Jew in his life than the question of, is there an Amalek? Is there an Erev Rav? People focus on those points. I don't think that's so important. Korach, I think, is very important. I think every person is faced in his life at least once, if not more than once, with the challenge of whether he will join Korach's group. I don't think the challenge of Korach ever ends. I think throughout Jewish history, we see the Sadducees, the Karaites, the Maskilim, the Reform. Every generation has their Korach that comes and says, don't believe the tradition. And I don't think we're done. You know, it's every time it takes on a new face, but it's really the same Korach coming out with a long white beard. You know, Moses Mendelssohn had a long white beard. Coming out and saying, don't go with the tradition. So the Netivot Shalom says you have to view it as a very contagious disease. Then you can understand. And that's why the children too were punished. He says it's not a punishment. They don't deserve a punishment. The idea is that everyone was affected. If you had imagine people with the Ebola virus. Imagine there were children with the Ebola virus. They're only 3 days old. You'd say, don't quarantine them. They don't deserve it. It's not a question of deserve it. There's a danger to everyone around. You can't say, don't quarantine them. He says,
everyone was affected, and so everyone posed a threat of infecting everyone else. And that's why the Torah gives such breadth, such length to the story of Korach, to tell us that you shouldn't view machlokes as something that's just conceptual. You should realize that machlokes is like a very, very dangerous virus. It's out there. And when people are affected, it can hurt everyone. And our sages came back and said, look at the parsha closely. Look at how it affects generations to come. Look at how it affects even the babies. Look at how Hashem says you can't leave any remnant around, even a needle, because it can affect. The essence of the Torah, coming back to the idea he said earlier, sometimes the Torah has concepts which it doesn't spell out, but it's like built in. This is the idea. Connect to the Ribbono Shel Olam. And if you're going to come and say, no, they don't know what they're talking about, they don't represent Torah, so then what you're really, you're a step away from saying there's no real way to connect to Hashem. Hashem is out of the picture. And when a person connects to his Rebbe, so then what he's saying is, okay, he is part of a link in a chain. He's a link in a chain, and so then I can connect. I can connect back to Sinai. Through connecting to that chain, I can also connect their Ribbono Shel Olam. And I can connect to life, and I can connect an understanding of how Hashem wants me to lead my life in this world. The Netivot Shel Olam is really touching on a nerve over here. He's touching on a few nerves. He's touching on the question that the Maharal says plagues every Jew. The question where every Jew does not want to connect through a Rebbe. The Maharal says, part of us says, what do I need him for? He's human just like me. Why should he be my link in the chain? I want to connect directly to the Ribbono Shel Olam. The Maharal says, that's why Jews didn't want to accept the oral law. The written law, Nasa v'nishma. The oral law, you got to hold the mountain over the head. Otherwise, they say, we don't really want it. We don't want an oral tradition that requires learning through this labyrinth of Talmud. Wow. Who understands Talmud? It's so hard. So many words, so many concepts. You learn here, and suddenly you hear that there's a Gemara there. You learn there. You say, there's another Gemara in a third place. You learn the Gemaras. They tell you, but there's a Rashi somewhere else who really explains all this. What's going on here? It's never spelled out clearly. You got to work a long time till you start understanding. You start tractate Shabbos. They don't tell you anything about Shabbos, right? You got to reach the seventh chapter, second Mishnah, till you hear there are 39 prohibited actions. What's going on here? You start Kilayim. Do they tell you, hey, the fundamentals of Kilayim is crossbreeding is prohibited when you want it to be crossbred that way, and it is obvious to everyone that that's what you want. Just tell me that, and suddenly the whole Masechta plays itself out clearly. But you got to learn and learn and learn until you get there. Oral Torah is very hard. It takes a lot of work. The Jewish people didn't want it. They said, who wants it? What do we need to do that? Let us interpret what God says. I want a direct connection to Ribbono Shel Olam. Don't want him in the way. No, no, no. Hashem says it doesn't work that way. You could learn and you could be the rabbi, but you got to learn. Got to learn the tradition. It's hard work and got to work hard. They didn't want that. No one wants that. So he's touching on that nerve, that idea that within every one of us, we are susceptible to that virus that says, don't want that. But he's also touching on another nerve. The idea that when you there's this elemental question, there's this elementary question, can I connect to the Ribbono Shel Olam? Is there really a connection? You know, I remember a guy wanted to illustrate this to me. He said to me, come with me. It was the end of a Thursday night class. He says, I want to explain to you what I want to do before Shacharis. Okay, don't laugh. This was a serious conversation. The guy takes me up. It was one of those Thursday nights where we learn until 3, 4 in the morning. The Beis Medrash is empty and dark. We walk into the Beis Medrash. He says, you know what I want to do every morning before Shacharis? I said, I don't know. Read all of Tehillim. He said, watch. He looks at the Aron HaKodesh. He cups his hands over his mouth and says, hello? Anyone out there? He said to me, you know, before I start davening, I want their Ribbono Shel Olam to say, yeah, I'm here, talk to me, son. He says, but I'm not supposed to do that, right? I said, you're right, you're not supposed to do that. He said, but you know, I stand Shmona Esrei, and my first thought, my second thought, my third thought is that. Oh, wait a second. I said to him, don't you ever feel connection? So first he said, no. And I said to him, I don't believe you. And he said, and I'm telling you no. And I said, and I'm telling you, I don't believe you. So he said, okay, but I'm telling you the truth. I said, okay, I respect you, fine. Years later, he came back to me and said, you were right. years. We stood there in the Beis Medrash and I said, I don't believe you. At some point you felt a connection and you had to ask yourself, is it there or isn't it there? And you chose to say it's not there. It didn't happen. It's not true that it never happened, that somewhere deep down inside you felt, I'm connecting to something. And then you decided, nah, it's not real. You chose not to connect, but that's a choice. You can't say it didn't happen. And for years he said no. And then, mamash, a few years later, we met again. And he said, you know, you were right. It's the truth. I did. I said, okay. I didn't know then. It's very hard to stand against someone who tells you no, and you say yes. And he says, but I told you no. I'm not lying to you. I want to connect. I remember him standing there saying to me, I want that feeling, but it's never happening to me. I said, I don't think so. I think you're choosing. You're choosing. So when the Netivot Shalom comes back to this point and says, if you sever that, then you're severing the potential for connection, he's also touching on the point that we all have that dichotomy within us. I want to connect. I want to connect and feel like I'm connecting. And how do I know if I'm connecting? Well, you know what? Part of it is tradition. Part of it is what you get when you say, I respect the person, I respect what he's telling me, I respect that he's telling me the truth. That's the huge danger in what's going on here. If Moshe missaid something, then there's no, that's why Hashem automatically punishes him for hitting the rock. But what's the big deal? Hashem said speak and he did hit. Hashem says no. Once you're off on one thing, then if I don't react harshly, then what's the reliability of anything else you said? So the Ribbono Shel Olam comes back real hard on the one time that Moshe misrepresents what Hashem says. The Ribbono Shel Olam says that's not acceptable, to the point where I'm not willing to forgo it. And Moshe prays over 500 times asking for forgiveness, and Hashem says no. So when the Magid Midovna, when the Netivot Shalom tells us that this idea of working with a Rebbe, connecting to a Rebbe, and viewing it as a way of connecting to the Ribbono Shel Olam, he's telling us many things. Again, he's telling us with a Hasidic flair, but he's telling us many points. He's touching on many nerves that we have within us. Nerves, I mean, in a spiritual sense. Points that we spend life hovering on them. Where we're connected, but there's still somewhere within us where we could feel more comfortable with it. We're comfortable to a degree. We could be more comfortable. It would be much nicer if when I walked into Shacharis, I'd say, Ribbono Shel Olam, give me $1 million. And I'd walk out of Shacharis and they'd hand me the check, right? Somehow it doesn't work that way, right? So then, Kaveh El Hashem, Chazak Yametzi Bechav, Kaveh El Hashem. Sometimes the answer is no. And sometimes you say, okay, but if the answer is no, then what am I doing here? It doesn't work that way, but it's hard. Our sages say one of the three things that require constant diligence is tefillah. It says when it comes to prayer, you got to keep strengthening yourself. It doesn't work. You could have kavanah. I thought I got there. I had kavanah. I was doing good. 30 days before Rosh Hashanah, 10 days Aseret Yemei Tshuva, I held out till Hanukkah. And then Hanukkah, somehow, I started walking into shul, and wait a second, aren't I talking to Ribbono Shel Olam? I tell myself that every so often, but it's just not there. And now Elul's around the corner. We're already in Tammuz. I'm Tammuz of Elul. What am I going to do? I'm a faker? It's just when Judgment Day comes that suddenly my tefillah is different? Our sages say it's normal. Sages say one of the three things that need diligence is tefillah. It takes avodah. It's avodah shebalev. It doesn't happen naturally. You know what else our sages say about? Eretz Yisrael. You come to Israel, you have a flair. You're excited. And then suddenly you're at the airport and the Nesher guy is trying to rip you off. And you're not so excited. Why are you trying to rip me off? I came here loving Jews in Israel. And then there's no air conditioning in the cab. And you say, why? I'm paying him good money. Why is there no air conditioning? And then you come and you discover that the tenant before you thought it was a good idea to take out all the light bulbs. Why leave you any light bulbs? You're paying for the apartment. Did you pay for the light bulbs? And you look at it and you start being bothered. And if that didn't bother you enough, they make you other problems. And you find the police at your door. You know, I had the police once come looking for Harry Potter. Someone did identity theft on Harry Potter. And they wouldn't believe me that Harry Potter didn't live in the apartment. And I'm looking at them and I'm saying,
don't you see it's as Harry Potter? They say he's racked up quite a bill. I said, it's as Harry Potter. And they're looking at me like I'm from Mars. And I'm saying, but look at what you're bringing me. What are you looking at me for? It's as Harry Potter. Someone did identity theft on Harry Potter. Don't ask me how we did it. But he got them convinced. He set up bills. He set up accounts on Harry Potter. He happened to put our address on it. So they come looking for Harry Potter. Okay, so, but it's not nice. It's better than putting my name. Harry Potter, I could say, never lived in this apartment. You know, that was easy. It's a very serious joke. Chazal say these things you got to work on them. It doesn't happen naturally. Naturally, you start saying, what do I need this for? And then you have to work on it. Tefillah, connection to Eretz Yisrael, yes. But I'm sorry, Yaakov was before you. I'm sorry, the other Yaakov.
Okay.
Yes.
I think maybe you answered some of the question, but really I'm trying to figure out how you, in any given situation, know that this is turning into a bad machloket. Because we also know that machloket sometimes can be good.
That's a great question.
Joke that there's always two opinions and there's two Jews, right? So like, how can it not be good also to have a bit of a good discussion?
That's a good question. Let's revisit that after we finish the Netivot Shalom. I want us to learn the Rambam on that. The Rambam gives us a formula.
Okay. Good.
Yes?
To follow up on what you were saying about that we have this unbroken tradition and we're meant to match together. So we seem to be saying to the effect that we're telling Jews that 2 + 2 = 4. There's no doubt. I have an unbroken tradition. So then why is it so challenging for non-religious Jews, or for those who are trying to become observant, to accept that 2 + 2 = 4? We have this unbroken tradition. It should be an automatic law. Is it the human tradition?